Hi, welcome back to the podcast. Today you're going to be hearing from Lindsay in Delaware. And if you ever thought that you couldn't heal from a benzodiazepine, I want you to hear from a woman who I consider one of the strongest women I've talked to, who has survived from a sinus infection to a fluoroquinolone to a steroid to a benzodiazepine. And then you're going to hear what happened to her after that. And then please listen afterwards to the post show when we talk when we're done speaking with Lindsay. Thank you. Hi, Lindsay. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here today because I always told you one of these days I'm like the godfather. I'm going to call you and say, I need a favor. And so today we're doing your podcast and I know you're nervous about doing it.
Yes, absolutely. But I'm glad you called me, Geraldine.
Oh, good, good. So, you know, you have a very complicated story of what was done to you. The iatrogenic illness is terrible. So I'm going to let you just take the whole beginning and tell us from, you know, how it all started and where it went from there.
Okay. Well, it actually started in 2006. I had a sinus infection that I had gone on a plane trip to Florida and picked up a sinus infection. And I had it for about a month before I went to the doctor trying to treat it naturally. When it didn't go away, I went to my physician and he gave me an antibiotic called Levaquin, a fluoroquinolone. When I finished that, I still had the infection. And so he then prescribed prednisone. I had a pretty rough reaction from that, couldn't sleep and was really high strung. It was a really difficult time. And that's when things began to go downhill. When I went back to him, he then gave me Klonopin to help me with sleep and relaxation. And unfortunately, I started Klonopin at that time. I was progressively ill for 2.5 years. And during that time, three different times I attempted to come off of the Klonopin. I didn't understand a lot about addiction and didn't even really know what was making me so ill. But I knew I could not get off of it on my own as hard as I tried. So the first attempt was I went to a hospital in Virginia where I went through a program where they give you flumazenil intravenously and immediately you stop the Klonopin abruptly. And so I did that I was there about a week. And then by the time I came back, I was in far worse shape than I had been when I first went there. So I went back quickly on the benzo after that. And my next attempt was at a rehab in Florida. I was there for about 10 days. Without going into a lot of detail, they took me off the Klonopin immediately. I think it was over 3 days. And by the time they sent me home, I was worse again. The third time I went to a local hospital to a detoxification unit, I was in the hospital for about 10 days again. I was treated terribly, just very, very poorly, and just called my husband crying to get me out of there and get me home. When he came and got me. By the time I came home, once again, I was far worse than I had been when I went in. So at that point, I started asking my children to help me find out what in the world I could do. My daughter that lives in California, actually, she found Geraldine for me. She found you. And that's how I got started on the road to recovery. However, it was really 5 years that I was extremely ill, fearful, in excruciating pain, nerve pain. And it was just very, very difficult time. It's been 10 years now since I came off of the drug. And at this point, I'm, I would say 90% healed. I still have surges of adrenaline, not as many, not nearly as many as I used to. However, they're not as painful as they were. They were extremely painful years ago, and the duration was a lot longer. At first, I had them every 5 minutes when I first came off the drug, Now I'm awakened by them in the night, maybe once or twice in the night, and I may have one or two during the day. So I can live with them, but still believing that I will recover from that as well. And that's pretty much my story. I'm able to live life now. I'm very grateful for every day and enjoy every day. I have 14 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren, and I'm able to enjoy them, spend time with them, and live my life again. And so pretty much that's my story. I want to say that I focus not a lot now on my faith. I enjoy life. I have a lot more peace than I ever had even before this happened. And so you do get a strength after you recover from this that you've never had before. So I just would like to encourage everyone that way, those that are going through it now.
Right, because somebody with, you know, they're coming off of one drug and you were harmed by many drugs. So now, because I know your history, I'm going to ask you some questions because I'm sure people are going to be interested. The flumazenil, you know, I know a few people tried it and I really don't know anybody that was successful with it. So if somebody was considering it, can you explain, did they ever explain to you that these drugs, that you were dependent on the drugs, or they just, you know, took the money? Was this covered under insurance? Do you know? And what was it like having it done? And then when you left there sick, because I think they knew you left there sick, was there any explanation that you'll recover at some point? What do you think? What can you remember about that?
Well, first of all, I would not recommend it for anyone coming off of benzodiazepine, because your brain has got to adjust to your life without the drug, as we all know, and that gives you no time to do that. I think that may work for maybe a heroin addiction or some other type of addiction, but certainly not for benzodiazepine. And I don't think they knew back then a whole lot about the benzo withdrawal and what I would go through, because when they sent me home, they basically said, you're good to go now. They gave me some Lyrica to take for the nerve pain, which was very, really terrible also. And so they really did not understand what I would go through when I went home. So I would definitely tell everyone to absolutely avoid that.
Right. And then now when you went to the facility in Florida, so again, this is a rehab, this is out of pocket, you're paying out of pocket. And I remember you telling me it was, first of all, it was an aide who came to you and said that it's the drugs that are making you sick. But one of the things, when you went there and they took you off in 3 days and you were there for 10 days, what are they doing with you during that time? I know you said you thought you'd be by a pool relaxing, but what are they doing with you when they've yanked you off and they see how sick you are?
Well, basically, this rehab was really designed for people coming off of alcohol and other drug addictions, mm-hmm. like heroin, but certainly not for what, there was no one else that I met in that facility that was going through what I went through. So they really couldn't understand me. I wanted to stay in my room and just lay in my bed in the fetal position. I cried all the time and they really couldn't understand what was going on. They would require me to go to the meetings, but that was all about, coming off of alcohol. And almost everyone that stood up and spoke, it was about alcohol. So really there was no provision there for what I was going through at all. And yes, an aide did come to me and say, what you're going through is a benzo withdrawal. It's completely different from this. And that was the first time I started to realize that there was something more to what I was experiencing. And that right. It was after that time that I went home and started really digging more deeply into what was happening to me.
Right. And then while you're there, it's while you're in Florida that your mother passes away. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then you've got to come home and do your mother's funeral and speak at it when you are as sick as a person can be.
Yes. To be honest with you, I have no idea how I was able to do that. I was in such bad shape, but I remember riding to the funeral, which was in another state. in the backseat of the car, writing down notes of what I was going to say. My thoughts were so unclear. I had no idea how to hardly keep a sentence together, but I was determined to get up and speak to my family because just out of honoring my mother. So I did it somehow, but it was a really difficult thing to do.
I don't know how you did it. And now, so from, you know, you've been through a lot. So from all the cold turkeys and the rehabs. Oh, well, before we even get into that. So then from there, now, you know, you go back on the benzo again, and now you go into detox at a hospital. So here comes another 10 days. You're in a hospital, and anybody there at any point recognize that you are sick from a benzodiazepine or that anything along the way has harmed you?
No, absolutely not. There was no mention of it. They took me off the benzo within, again, just a couple days and gave me an antidepressant. That was the next thing that they put me on. And I was so ill, again, crying, couldn't sleep at all. And I remember walking down to the nurse's station in tears one night, and I literally passed out on the floor. I was so weak. And they, as far as I know, I don't know how long I was out, but when I woke up, I was laying there by myself. I wasn't even taken back to my room. And they treated me as if I was overreacting, you know, that it was all in my head. And they, because I remember they said, "Mrs. McAllister, go back to your room now." That's what they said to me.
Right. So no kindness, no compassion, nothing.
No. And I had never been, I was so naive. I had never been treated like that or experienced anything like it. So I called my husband the next day, told him what happened, and he and my son came and got me and took me out of there.
Right.
Which, right. You know, when I came out, I was again worse than when I went in. So
right. This is three times now you're being cold turkey, basically. And they're treating you like an addict because we're not addicts. These drugs, we became very dependent on them. And I think in each facility, they treated you as if you're some type of an addict. You know, you're trying to get off the drugs, not drug seeking, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I wasn't addicted by choice. I was addicted, but it was not by choice. It was by naivety.
Right, right. It's a dependency. You know, are addictive drugs that we become dependent on, but it's always blame the patient, not the drug. I mean, it's really it's a crime. It's a shame. So you had a lot going on. And I know, so one of the things is when you first contacted me and I heard your story, but I also knew that you were a very healthy person. You were a health fanatic. You know, you exercised, you ate well. So we figured, I don't think I knew when you first contacted me the extent of all that was done to you, because it, you know, when you hear it, it even makes me anxious today to hear all that was done to you. Mm-hmm. And we figured, okay, you know, you're going to continue to eat well. But, you know, we thought, okay, you'll be better in a year. And we both know it. You were not better in a year because with all that was done to you, your brain originally was just, it was on high speed. And I had said to you, you're going to, you know, it'll speed. And then it's going to catch up and it will start to slow down. And so some of the things you did because your brain just wouldn't shut down. You did a lot of, and I think this is good for people to hear. You did a lot of different things, you know, different craft projects. Like, remember you doing, your husband would go buy you book after book of Sudoku. You'd whip through them. You were doing the embroidering of pillowcases. And I think you had mentioned yesterday, and I forgot about this, that you were drawing a lot. You had to have that brain functioning. It wouldn't stop.
Yes, absolutely. I had to be doing something all the time. And yet I was too weak to really right. get up and do things, leave my house. Well, I was too afraid to leave my house. But yes, absolutely. My brain was going so fast. I needed to be doing something constantly. So the artwork was the main one. As I look back on it all, I would just sketch. I would buy flowers and just sketch flowers or animals or birds that I would see outside, just anything that one time I sat in my husband's office, which was in our home, and sketched him sitting at his desk. So yeah, I did anything that I could to occupy my mind. I had, it was just going so fast.
Right. But now let's talk about one of your hardest symptoms, which was sleep. And, you know, and this was a drug induced, you had drug induced fears, you were petrified that you wouldn't sleep, and you couldn't sleep. You were having back then so many adrenaline rushes. And your husband, who is absolutely amazing, he used to, one of the things he did was take you out for a ride at night like a baby in the hopes that you would fall asleep. And one of the other things, and again, people need to know these fears because I'm honest about mine. One of yours was you were afraid you wanted him awake when you slept. You just, you couldn't be alone, because I understood that I couldn't be left alone. But this was even if you slept, you needed to know that he was there or somebody was there. So tell us a little bit about that and how you got through it. And
well, I didn't do very well at getting through it, to be honest with you. My husband stayed with me all the time. When he was asleep, I was very scared because I was alone. I would just lay there waiting for him to wake up because I really couldn't sleep. I was exhausted and I would fall asleep for maybe 5 minutes. Then I'd have a surge of adrenaline and be awakened and then be wide awake once again. So it's exhausting beyond anything that you can imagine. And so it was really a difficult time. I began to really fear when the sun would go down because I knew the world would go to sleep and I'd be wide awake again.
And right. That's a very, very scary, again, because you're scaring yourself knowing what's coming at night, which you're afraid of. And we've got people all over the world going through that. Yeah. So because your husband was your main support person, I mean, I used to say to you, because you were so sick and you'd be in your robe all day, I'm like, he doesn't want to look at you as a patient. It's hard enough. You know, he's taking care of you. And I think for those of us, even for my husband, if I knew he was coming in the door, I'm like, oh, I can't be on the sofa. And at least I tried to take a shower every day and put my jeans on and a top and just fake it. You know, as Madeline, one of my moderators used to say, you fake it till you make it.
Yes.
And then we have to do things for our husbands because they're taking care of us. We're their wives, and yet we have become a patient. So I used to, you know, I wanted you to make sure you took a shower, you know, put your clothes on and try to do little things for him because you couldn't have him go out and get away from you, which you need, he needed, you know, and even it would have been good for you to have a break. So little things. I remember once you took a picture, you set the table so beautiful. It was picture perfect. You sent me a picture of that. So just little things people can do to help our support people.
Well, yes. Because you can't leave your home often, there you are. So you have to kind of make your home as beautiful as possible. So I would love to get flowers and put them around the house. As you say, set the table with just pretty little things that that make it more appealing. Also make the food more appealing by doing that. So it was just little things like that that were really, really helpful. And when you mentioned, let me just go back to getting out of bed every day. I really didn't want to even get out of bed. I was just so weak. Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Hey, this podcast, we can do what we want. We're just going to leave that in there. This is life.
Okay, good. And It was just a very difficult time to do that. I had to force myself to get out of bed, force myself to get dressed, to brush my hair, but I was determined to do it every single day. Right. And we did that. I thank you for encouraging me with that. I probably would have stayed in bed many days, but I never did. I always got out of my bed. I made my bed, got dressed, you know, took shower, washed my hair, and, just try to keep on with life as much as possible. And I would highly recommend that to anyone that might be struggling in that area because it lifts your own spirits just to be able to do that every day.
Right. So with your husband being your only support person, really, who's right there. So he educated himself. He stepped up. He did the food shopping, the laundry, driving you around at night. Literally, he was your lifesaver. Plus, the whole time while trying to run the business, of which you did the books for. So I just want you to talk a little bit about him because he truly, not too many, as much as my husband lived through it, he didn't want to read a thing. He didn't want to do a thing. And yet I was so dependent on him. So I am so grateful for that, because these guys are out doing everything we should be doing and we can't, we want to. So I want you to tell us a little bit about your husband, because I would put him right up there with one of the top two support people. He really was phenomenal.
He really was, more than I even knew at the time. He actually handled everything. He paid all of our bills. I didn't even have to think about that at all. As you said, he went grocery shopping. We didn't do a whole lot of cooking. We would even go out and get food, carry out, and bring that home when I couldn't cook. He did the laundry, just every of the duties that I once did, he took over. And even the bookkeeping that I had been doing for years, I could no longer do it. It was so stressful. It was hard for my brain to think about all those figures. I was concerned that I would make errors. In fact, I did make a couple. And at one point, finally, I said, I just can't do it anymore. And he even took that over. So, yes, he did it all. He really kept me alive. I would not have been able to stay in that home or have just the basic necessities, just, you know, of food and heat and shelter. I completely depended on him, hardly even knew it at the time because I was in such a terrible state of mind, but he absolutely did it all. Yes, he did.
I remember one time what he did, because again, I was trying to keep your mind grounded, mm-hmm. and we were going to Skype and make a meal together, and it was going to be a little bit of a difficult meal. And he went out, he bought everything that I had here, and we Skyped, and we were making a Filipino dish that my neighbor had taught me to make. And sure enough, he bought everything, and then we were FaceTiming or Skyping, and we each cutting everything up and doing it, you know. And I mean, how many husbands would do that, you know, but he did it. And he really is a great guy.
Yes, he is. And I remember that day we did that. Honestly, I felt like I was a part of life again to be able to do that. As bad as I felt, it was actually fun to do that. And then to have that meal at the end of it to give to my husband was just a great thing. So
right. And the reason we're mentioning this is because this is where benzo friends come in, where, you know, you meet people online, whether it's in Benzo Buddies or on some of the Facebook groups. Now, these are things when somebody is secluded that you can help another person. So I want to talk about some of the things that you did to survive. So one of your daughters is a phenomenal piano teacher. And so she Skyped with you to try to teach you how to play the piano. That was one thing. And then we had some people in other countries in different time zones speaking with you to give your husband a break. He even brought in, I believe he brought in paid staff at one point because he needed a break. And even my own sister-in-law helped you at night. So there are, you know, over the phone, you just needed to be on the phone with somebody that somebody else was, you know, listening when you were suffering. And I think these are things that other benzo people or your family or friends can do for you. But when we were talking earlier, I had an email from 10 years ago that you didn't know that I had. Your daughter, one of your daughters had sent me an email asking what she can do to help when she's on the phone with you. So I'm not going to read the beginning because that was pertaining to your symptoms, what I knew was improving as time was going by. But this would be really for any benzo person, if they have a support person listening, these are some of the things that I told her that change is good, whether it's good or bad. As long as things are changing, we know things are happening. And sometimes symptoms will escalate beyond tolerance right before they go away. So we're having a bad day, I wanted her to remind you of this. And usually if you can take a nap during the day, then you would have actually a better night that night. Because a lot of people fight taking a nap. They're afraid of that toxic nap, but it's like you got to take it whenever you can take it. And when you were having a bad day, it was to keep you in the moment, that you were constantly dreading the nights and only think the worst, and that, you know, to keep you in the now. So again, I'm saying all this because it pertains to everybody. And also, when you got really bad, remind her this is not her life. It is just now. She pictures herself sick for the rest of her life, so keep her grounded. And I said, for me, I can tell her all the symptoms that she doesn't have that others have, and she's grateful for that. But I also don't like her to carry anyone else's burden. So, because then you would think about somebody else and it would bother you. Because I am a big believer that when we're sick, we can't take on somebody else's sickness. So, and then when she is negative, always turn her to the positive, because she can't think things through. And, you know, you need a little bit more help to become. Now, that pertains to all of us going through this. And I thought, boy, I wrote that 10 years ago.
Yes.
To her. And you never knew that she and I had even had that email till today.
No, I did not until today. And yeah. And absolutely, that is exactly how it was, Geraldine. You cannot, for some reason, you just, even if you have the slightest bit of improvement, you can't even accept that it's improvement. It just seems like it's just not real. It won't last. My brain would constantly go to the negative aspect of it. And I constantly needed reassurance and encouragement. And for some reason, it's difficult to muster that up on your own. No matter how much you are improving, it's difficult to see it. And you always think you're going to go back into the negative part of it. So,
yeah, right.
That's absolutely true. And I was so glad to hear that you had told that to my daughter, because unless you've been there, you can't understand that. When I think of my husband, I think he had no idea what was happening to me. And he just had to go by what he was hearing from you and from myself. You know, and nobody can know unless they've experienced it themselves.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, so let's talk for a minute about diet. Okay. Because as you know, I'm not a big fan of a vegetarian diet when somebody has been harmed by medication and trying to heal. And again, not that vegetarians aren't going to heal, because one of the girls who I would love to have on, but she's very nervous about doing a podcast, was a vegetarian, but she made sure she got a lot of protein in other sources. So you were a vegetarian. You were very healthy, very, very healthy prior to being poly-drugged. But you did reintroduce meats into your diet, and then every now and then you try to go vegetarian again and you'd feel sicker. So let's talk about what worked and what didn't and how you're eating today.
Okay. Actually, I was actually vegan before I got started. Mm-hmm. I ate, you know, fruits, vegetables, legumes, rices, and those kind of things. Once I ended up in the benzo experience, I could not stay with that, because I was so sensitive to everything, that to all most foods, that I had to go back into eating meats again and some small amounts of dairy. And I did that for a while, but I honestly never felt well. I didn't feel good any time. So I can't say it had anything to do with the meats, but I did do that for a while just because I didn't know what to do. I was so ill. However, as I started to feel better after many years, I did go back into the vegan diet, which is what I do now. And I don't know if you want to know what I do now, but I'd be glad to tell you if you would like
sure.
to. So now I do almost all raw vegan. I eat large amounts of greens, about a pound a day of spinach, kale, broccoli, those type of things. I make smoothies out of them, and I don't eat a lot of starches like rices and things like that, but I do eat a lot of beans or lentils, peas, those kind of things. And so basically that's my diet now. And it's a very good one. I'm doing well on that. And, I feel like that's what my body was used to before, and it does really well with that now.
Good, good. Now, one of the things, this is something people think, do I get a pet? Do I not get a pet? And during your illness, you did get a dog, and a beautiful one. So, what are your thoughts on that? Because for you, Bella was very much a comfort, and it also helped you to get out, walk the dog. So I want you to tell me how that helped you.
Well, she was a wonderful help, because she would sleep on my bed, which I was in bed so much that I now had a companion with me. And when my husband couldn't be there, I had her right there by my side. So she was just wonderful, perfect timing in my life. And I would highly recommend that if you're a person that likes animals, because they, you know, they are a wonderful companion, and they distract you from how you feel. And as you say, you have responsibility of feeding them, caring for them, taking them for walks. So it helped to take my attention off myself as well. And so we still have her. We've had her about 9 years now. We just really still enjoy her very much. So yes, I would recommend a pet if you like them, if you enjoy them.
Right, right. And I think for you, it really did work out. She really was such a comfort. So I want to talk about something a little serious now, if you don't mind. So because you had a long road to recovery, because, you know, one of your worst things was sleep, and you thought drinking alcohol would help, and I begged you not to do it. So that's one of the things that set you back. And again, just you, that started out a little bit, and you're not the only one that's done it. There are others that have done it too. The second was you took Phenibut, which, you know, I warned people not to take that. And so again, you know, you were taking that, and you even were taking a high dose because you just wanted to sleep so bad. And then the third thing that happened, your family, again, they're not fully understanding everything. You know, they forced you to take a benzodiazepine. It was only one time, you know. And then the fourth, you tried to take your life. But thank God you're still here and strong. So, and the reason I mention this is because people give up and they can't take much more. And I want them to see that you do come out on the other side, in which you are healthy, even though you say you're 90 to 95% healed. Nobody can see what's wrong. You function fine. And you did get to the other side, considering how many drugs you were given that just one would cause a side effect. Do you want to talk about any of this just to encourage people to keep going? Because you were so desperate to sleep because you couldn't shut down.
Sure. Well, let's see. The alcohol, I never drank prior to the benzos. And so I didn't know how that would affect me. I didn't do well with alcohol, so that didn't last very long at all. I felt worse. That was not helpful to me at all. In fact, if anything, it made my mind more in a type of depression. So I really, that was not a good thing for me, and I wouldn't recommend that to anyone. The Phenibut, yeah, I had gone to a nutritionist who recommended that. I tried it. And would you believe the first night I slept 4 hours straight? That was the first time in years. It was heavenly for me. And he assured me that it was not addictive. So I thought, this is wonderful. I will be able to recover on this and keep taking it. However, I would have to keep taking a little more to get the same effect. I will say, in its behalf, that it did get me through quite maybe even a year of time where I was able to rest a little more and heal. So I am grateful for that. However, again, I would not recommend that if you can get through this without doing anything like that, because in the end, then I had to have a withdrawal from that.
We know there are others that said the withdrawal from that was identical to coming off of benzos.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I warn people, do not take it.
Yes, absolutely. I would say the same thing. It wasn't as difficult for me to come off that, but still not pleasant. It was just another thing that I'd had to go through. So no, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone.
No. Good.
So that was my experience with that. I also tried marijuana for a few times because a lot of people I hear are doing that. For me, that was just maybe 2 or 3 times in the evening I would take it or I guess smoke it. Try to help me sleep. And it made me so much worse that I wouldn't recommend that to anyone either. They, you know, people do that for calming, but it didn't do that for me. Instead, my mind raced more and was even more fearful. So that was just definitely not good for me. I was to the point where I was suicidal. This was probably, I'm going to say 3 or 4 years after I had come off the abrupt stopping of the drug. And I, At this point, I was still in extreme nerve pain, crying every day, laid in bed with ice packs and heating pad. I was depressed. I was concerned that I was just nothing but a burden to my husband. And I decided I just didn't want to live anymore. I wrote notes to all my children to say goodbye and tell them how much I loved them. And then I just decided I would end it all. I at the last minute decided not to. I'm so glad that I did, because not long after that, I'm going to say within 6 months, my life started to turn around for the better. So I'm so grateful that I didn't go through with it, but I came very, very, very close.
Right. And look, at I always say anybody who says they don't think about it is a liar, because I thought about it constantly. I wrote goodbye notes, not because I would have done something. Mm-hmm. I just didn't think I was going to live through the night. I never thought I would live. And then you'd wake up in the morning and think, oh, I have to do it again. I mean, it's yeah. torturous.
Right. Exactly. When I would sleep, when I'd wake up in the morning, I'd think, oh, no, another day. That was literally my first thought when I woke up, another day. And yeah, but I would say to anyone contemplating that, no matter how bad it gets, no matter how you think you want your life to end, your life will turn around if you press through that and just refuse to believe that lie and just move forward, because it's a wonderful life when you come out of it. Just wonderful life ahead once you are not controlled by that drug anymore. And that is such a distant memory now. It's hard for me to even imagine, as much as I love life now, that I would have even considered that. And I'm just so grateful to be alive every day. And so that's what I would say to anyone. I understand how a person would feel going through that. I was there. I know it very well. But yeah. I'd say push through it, whatever it takes. Muster up inside yourself to get the strength to say, no, I'm going to go on. If it could be, you know, put a picture of your children in front of you, or your spouse, or your friends, whoever it may be, parents, whatever you love, your pet, place it in front of your eyes so that every day you can see them and give you hope and reason to keep on going.
Right. No. So one of the other things I forgot to mention this, and it's just reminding me, again, this is where benzo friends or family or neighbor, anybody you're close with that you trust, because like me, you were stuck in the house and you couldn't drive and you were trying to take your independence back. So you would get in the car and we called it your circle of safety, and you would drive around your circle of safety and we'd talk. And even one of the other moderators used to do the same thing for her, be on the phone with her to get her out of the house and get her driving so she could go get a part-time job. I mean, this is what's important, and this is what we're trying to teach people. What will it take to help you? That was, you know, we would laugh while you were doing it. I mean, because there's nothing to laugh about when you're going through this, and you got to find those moments when you can laugh a little bit. And we did. You'd drive around and we'd joke a little bit while you were driving around your circle of safety. And the neighbors, you were wondering, what are they thinking in that circle of safety that they just keep seeing you driving around the same circle?
Yes. Well, it was really pretty wonderful for me, to be honest, at the time, because I felt it was my only source of independence. I could get out behind the wheel by myself and drive. It was probably about a 4 mile circle that I would drive, maybe five. And we live in the country, so they were backcountry roads. And I did that probably for years. I can't remember how long it was, but I would look at the scenery would change. I would look at the flowers, the horses in the pasture. I mean, it was just a wonderful time for me. And it's really all I could do, because I was in such a state of mind that I was pretty much just staring at things. I had no emotion. You know, I was emotionless pretty much during that time. But it was one thing that I could do to get out of the house. And I did it every single day, maybe a couple times a day, just to get out and see life again.
Right.
So, yeah.
So with all that you've gone through, and again, you were poly drugged. I mean, all they just kept doing was throwing drugs at you, which is, it's just a crime. At no point did anybody say to you, look, you're just sick from the drugs. They just kept throwing them to you. So with all that you've gone through, because we're coming to the end of this, and what advice would you have for somebody listening who's struggling from an iatrogenic, which is a drug-induced, doctor-induced illness?
I would say stay focused on things around you. Do things that you enjoy, little things. It might be a warm bath at night with bubble bath in it, listening to soft music or whatever kind of music you enjoy. Pamper yourself in any way that you can. Listen to or watch movies that are soothing to you, or play with your pets. Just anything, any little thing you can enjoy, try to pamper yourself with those things. It could be cooking or whatever it is. Just try to stay focused on what you can enjoy. If there's anyone else that you can help, I used to call people that were in the same situation that I was, and I would talk with them and tell them successes I would have to try to encourage them. And just if you can get hooked in with other people that are going through it, where you can encourage each other, that's also a wonderful thing.
Right. It's that constant reassurance is what gets us through.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So my new thing that I'm doing is I want to ask everybody, what's the craziest thing a doctor ever said to you?
I would say, and I heard this often, you need to take more of the drug and you will be on this the rest of your life. What a lie that was, because the more I would take, I never even got up to extremely high amount, to be honest with you, because I was always fearful of what they told me. But you would get a short, brief period of time from that advice, and then you were back in even worse than you were before. So it's just a terrible lie that they will tell you that you need more of the drug, that there's something wrong with you, that you won't ever come out of this. It's a lifetime experience that you're going to have to stay with. That was the worst lie that I ever faced. It took me a little while to realize that that was not the truth. Once I did, the people that had been through it, you especially, would say, don't ever touch the drug again and you'll heal from this, which was the opposite of what the doctors said. And I clung to that. And that would be my best advice, is to listen to the people that have recovered, that know that there is a way out of it. If you will stay away from the drug, you will heal. It takes time, and that time frame is different for every person. So nobody really knows how long it will take you to heal. But the best thing you can know is that you will heal if you stay with it. And I just want to thank you, Geraldine, so much. You saved my life. Definitely, you saved my life by walking me through this. And I can never thank you enough for what you did. If I hadn't had your expertise, your advice, your loving care toward me, I would have never had the life that I enjoy now. And I will always be grateful to you and love you for it.
Oh, well, thank you. Love you too. And I'm so glad that you made it to the other side. And I want to thank you so much for doing this today, Lindsay.
Thank you. My pleasure, Geraldine.
All righty. Okay. Hi, Garrett. We just finished our interview with Lindsay, and that was a tough one to listen to with all that she went through, because you kids actually heard a lot over the years as she and I talked on the phone.
Yeah, so I remember her being on you used to have a Bluetooth in your ear as we would be driving to Marshfield or whatever, and sometimes we would think that you'd be talking to us, but then you were actually talking to her, so I do remember Lindsay. I don't think maybe I ever talked to her.
Right.
But, yeah, she was a pretty consistent part of your life for a long time.
Yeah. Well, because you become very close with people. And this is something that others can be doing for each other, which is why she and I wanted to mention. This is what it takes to get people over the hump. And when we actually finished the show, her and I talked for a minute, and she wanted to there was a statement that she wanted to say, and it was that she is now stronger in her faith, stronger in character, stronger with her joy, and she said she's even better than before, even though she has that, maybe she's like 90-95% healed now, and she had a statement saying, God strengthens us through the howling winds of hardship, and she said that that's really true for what she's gone through.
Yeah, and I think this interview was, eye-opening for me because I had heard how bad it was when it was at its worst, and because I could hear you talking to her, and she seemed to me, because I was younger at the time, like I was, like she was one of those people that maybe was never going to.
Excuse me.
She was never going to get better. Like it had gotten so bad, there was never getting over the hump. But you heard her in that interview just now, and she sounds fine.
She does sound fine. Excuse me, I have something, I don't know what went down my throat, but yeah, I am, I'm so grateful to see her now on the other end. And I just think people need to know, no matter what you're going through, she did make it. She never thought she would make it to the other side.
Yeah, and I think it's worth mentioning the time that we're recording this episode, and we're probably going to get a bunch of episodes done that, we're trying to make these episodes so that they kind of exist in perpetuity. They're not set to any time stamp or anything like that, but, we're a couple of days into the COVID-19 outbreak, so we're all kind of looking for things to do, and actually, it's particularly bad here in New England because we just found out that Tom Brady's not coming back to the Patriots. So it's...
Not that I care about that so much, but as New Englanders, yes, that's a big deal.
And it's St. Patrick's Day, so it's like maybe the worst day in the history of Boston type.
Right.
But it's good to hear a story like Lindsay's because, it's kind of like one of those things. It's no matter how bad it gets. You can always get better. You can just hang in there. There is light at the end of the tunnel.
Right. Right. And if other benzo people would just do what she and I did, just be a buddy to somebody. It just gets you through because I see a lot of things on the internet right now with the whole, coronavirus that people are saying, people have to be secluded in their homes. We've been secluded in our homes for years. So think about that. All these people that have suffered have been alone where people don't call them or bring food by. And now because of the virus, they're saying people are secluded, go check on them. But we all live those lives, every single one of us. A lot of us have been talking to each other about that. And it's nothing to laugh about because it was something very serious. I mean, my friends were pretty decent because, on the phone, I couldn't go out with them. I was too sick. But right now, maybe people are getting a little sense of what all of us went through in our seclusion.
So let me ask you this then. If you had been coming off of the drugs when this, outbreak happened, do you think it would have made it worse for you just because of the anxiety with everything going on?
So, I hate to say, I don't have a lot of anxiety over the virus right now because...
Well, given the way that your nervous system was at the time, do you think it would have had a bigger impact on you?
Because I was so dependent on... If you kids were younger at the time and couldn't drive, I was so dependent on you people to go out and do the shopping. And I was out today doing the shopping. I was out early in the morning, and doing it. So I think when other tragedies have happened, again... Depending on where you are in your recovery, some are absolutely petrified. In fact, somebody texted me right when we were getting started. She is alone, has nobody. She's in her house absolutely petrified right now.
Do you think that's just because, people are letting their minds run wild? They don't have much to occupy their mind. So, the anxiety of what's going on, nationally and internationally is constantly, they're perseverating about it nonstop.
Well, I think for this girl that was texting, for her, because she's alone and has nobody, she's not well, and she has got no, she's afraid she's going to wind up in a hospital because she's stressing herself out so much right now. So, all we can do is just, take all the precautions we're supposed to take, number one. And for us, it has to be a little bit more because of Dad. We can't get him sick. So that's where us, we can't let Leanna in the house now, because she's working in a hospital and as of tomorrow, she's back in the emergency room. So no more coming by her or her husband. We can't have them expose us. But
yeah. And so we should probably explain that to everybody that Leanna, my sister, your daughter, she had been working in the PACU. So she was away from the emergency room, but that's where she originally was.
Right.
And now, because they've canceled all elective surgeries, there's not much use for a PACU nurse. So
right.
She's had to go back to the ER, and she's going to be directly exposed to.
And I knew she'd be. I said, "You're gonna wind up back in the ER." And sure enough, she texted today. She's like, "As of tomorrow, I'm back in the ER," which is fine. I mean, she's already trained. They don't have to get somebody in there to train. So, but I want to just get back to Lindsay for a minute because, you know, she said she's in the country. You know, she used to say, "I'm just this little country bumpkin," and she is a very strong woman. I mean. I think even the other day when we were talking, when I wanted her to do this, I didn't know she was given Lyrica. I didn't realize she was given the antidepressant. Mind you, she didn't stay on them long. She was constantly thrown out medication after medication or the flumazenil. I mean, it really is horrific. And the one thing that we've kind of all learned, if she couldn't drink alcohol when she was younger, neither could I. I've had a DNA test done. I believe she never did. So we now know genetically a lot of us cannot, we don't metabolize certain drugs. It should never have happened to her. It should never have happened to me. But it did. So anybody listening, and when you hear what she went through, you are going to get to the other side. You know, she really, like I said, she took care of her body. And as much as it was hurting, she tried and tried and tried. And she tried some things that didn't work, but she didn't really... I can say this from my own perspective. You don't want to be gone from this life. You just don't want to suffer anymore. So you just got to get past that point to when the body will finally start healing. And if she can heal through all of that, anybody can heal.
Yeah. And I think, too, it's probably worth mentioning, you know, in like national advisories, they've said, you know, check on your elderly neighbors, check on, you know, people that can't go out to shop. But, you know, it might be worth checking on your friends that may be dealing with something like this. And just a phone call would be helpful.
That's right. Show, this is a time to really step up and show compassion. Because once we've gone through something like this, we have such compassion. You heard her. She has such kindness and compassion in her for all that she went through. So... anybody listening, just don't give up and just, you know, help your body to heal the best you can.
All right. Then I think that's the end of this one.
All right. Thank you again, Garrett.
Thank you.